Hello, this is Jonathan Marks via PCJ Online, just about to push the button on another programme from the media network Vintage Radio Archives.
By shortwave and satellite, this is the Dutch International Service. Media Network, a weekly communication survey produced and presented by George Wood.
Hello, welcome to this edition, which includes the results of our cryptic quiz competition. But first, I'm joined by Pete Myers as we start the media news desk.
Well, George, there's been a development in the Middle East. You may recall that at the start of January, a medium wave station that had been testing with Palestinian music suddenly changed its programming. It became Radio Al-Quds, broadcasting mainly in Arabic to the Palestinians on the Israeli West Bank and Gaza Strip. The transmitter is believed to be in Syria, using a power of around 1,000 kilowatts. As from last Friday, the Israeli authorities decided to take action, as we hear now from Joop Meyers on the line from Jerusalem.
Well, since then, the Israeli, probably the military authorities, started jamming the transmissions of Al-Quds. And last week, Al-Quds decided to switch to another wavelength. And these days, you can again listen to Al-Quds, but on 630.
So that's 630 kilohertz.
630 kilohertz. And that's the way in which they try to circumvent the Israeli jamming, which is not successful because also at this new wavelength, the authorities apparently have decided to jam at least certain parts of the transmissions.
Let's listen to what it sounds like.
التي تخرج منها الفطاح وسوق الدير التجاري من أهم القرى هيازور بيت سجن.
Very effective jamming, at least where you are in Jerusalem. Joop, it sounds as though the Israelis are only broadcasting a tone to block out selected parts of the broadcast.
Last week, the jamming took place when Radio Al-Quds gave messages to the inhabitants of the occupied territories, in which they tried to scare into silence those people thought to collaborate with the Israeli authorities, policemen, all kind of people who work with the Israeli authorities. So they gave the name, the exact address, the villages where these people live. When that started, the jamming also started immediately. The last few days, the jamming starts when they are giving messages, probably also coded messages, to the inhabitants of certain villages within the occupied territories. It's very selective, and I guess that those people who are jamming are listening very carefully, and they have a very quick reaction time. Immediately when it starts, they jam.
Is the jamming effective in the West Bank?
The jamming is very effective. While the jamming is taking place, you cannot hear anything which is being broadcast by Al-Quds. Maybe some far background noise, but basically nothing.
So, Joop, what will happen next?
Well, it looks like a play of a cat and a mouse, you might say. One might assume that in the next few days Al-Quds might switch over to another wavelength again, and again the Israelis probably will try to jam the system, and that might continue for quite some time.
At the Berlin International Audio and Video Fair, held last September, around 20 electronics manufacturers displayed prototype radios incorporating the so-called Radio Data System, or RDS. Much of the pioneering work for this project was done in Sweden. But since RDS standards have been discussed and accepted by the European Broadcasting Union, continent-wide expansion on the system is taking place rapidly. So what does it do? Well, audience research shows that tuning a radio receiver to the right station on the dial is a major problem for most people. Even though most domestic broadcasting stations stay on exactly the same frequency year after year, it's only a small percentage of the listening public that regularly scans the dial for new sounds. Unless you know frequency tables by heart or recognize a particular program or presenter, you have to guess what channel you're listening to until a spoken identification is given between programs. That's particularly frustrating in a car when you're forced to tune about as you move out of the coverage area of different transmitters.
As far as the VHF-FM radio is concerned, the solution is to find a way to broadcast an electronic identification tag alongside the program being received. On a conventional radio, you wouldn't notice any difference. But on an RDS receiver, as you tune in a signal, a liquid crystal display shows which station you're listening to. For example, the letters HILR4 indicate you found Dutch Radio's Radio 4 network from Hilversum. The digitally encoded system requires modification at the transmitting end of the broadcast chain, too. The Swedish automobile manufacturer Volvo has been the first European company to market a car radio with RDS. Philips, Pioneer, Grundig and Blaupunkt have promised to follow suit in a couple of months. An expensive hi-fi tuner offering RDS made by Grundig is also available in West Germany. But it's in the car that RDS will be of most use. Henry van der Heijden, head of the Radio Data System of the Netherlands Broadcast Services, NOB, explained to us that current tests from the Lopik transmitter site in the center of the country are going very well.
Yes, there are very interesting tests just now going on. We have started these tests in the middle of last year, in July, and that are tests related to the transmission of traffic information within RDS.
Currently, programs have to be interrupted with live traffic information. Usually, the pop music channel carries this type of news, and unfortunately often gives the driver information which won't affect his or her particular route. The new digital RDS system offers a way to give the driver details on the local traffic situation whenever the driver decides it's needed. Because looking at a screen, as you can imagine, while you're trying to drive, would create its own hazards, the designers have come up with an audio solution.
He is not looking on a screen. He gets the information by means of a voice synthesizer. That's a much better way. And he will get the information always in his own language. That's also a very interesting feature. The traffic information is standardized over the whole of Western Europe.
The high speed at which the digital data is sent in audibly alongside the radio program is only currently possible using VHF-FM. But there's no reason why the same parameters couldn't be used on long, medium, and even shortwave transmitters to broadcast simpler data such as station identification, which could be displayed on the radio at home.
Curiously, though, no portable receivers have been announced yet. In Britain, some of the independent local radio stations fear that RDS will lead to confusion. In some areas, programs are shared with other nearby regional stations. And national news comes from a different source, the independent radio network in London. For that reason, the program identification on the receiver display will have to be kept rather general when it comes online at the end of March.
Media Networks Book Review.
Truth Betrayed is the title of a rather unusual book on British broadcasting in the period from 1930 to around 1941. Despite the claim on the book's inside jacket that it's the first to tackle the secret radio propaganda wars between Germany, Britain, Italy, and the Soviet Union, this topic has already been covered by authors across the continent before. However, the author, William J. West, is the first to discuss in depth on the activities of Guy Burgess, who worked at the BBC in the period up to the Second World War, and who later made headlines when he defected to the Soviet Union. We tried to contact William West for this program last week. Surprisingly, the author refused to take part in any radio interview for rather obscure copyright reasons. You'd expect, after all, that an author would be willing to talk about something he'd written. Still, he was prepared to react to any specific questions we had. Ginger De Silva's been paging through the 262 pages.
This is a very English book. It delves deeply into British politics of the 1930s and 40s, and examines how it influenced the British Broadcasting Corporation. In the author's opinion, there was mild censorship of BBC news and talks in the early 30s, leading to full-scale control once war broke out. That isn't all that surprising, bearing in mind that the BBC didn't have a news department 55 years ago and just put out reports verbatim that it got from Reuters news agency. It's not quite clear why the book devotes 20 pages to the revelation of how communist Guy Burgess got into the BBC and influenced some of the talks. The author shows through a series of elaborate references that this must have been the route taken by Burgess before moving on to the British security services. But one is tempted to say, so what, at the end of the chapter. Far more interesting are the accounts of clandestine broadcasts by the British.
Achtung, hier Gustav Siegfried ein.
That was a wartime black clandestine transmission. It claimed to be the voice of a disgruntled German Nazi officer. In fact, it was a short-lived but clever British propaganda station designed to sow seeds of discontent inside the German army. Its effectiveness is unknown. Before the war, though, the British government hired airtime on Radio Luxembourg and several other commercial stations on the European continent. Programs were designed to present the British viewpoint, being aimed at listeners in Germany, the Low Countries, Switzerland, and France. Organized under the banner of the Joint Broadcasting Committee, all the recordings were made under the strictest secrecy. Once war broke out, German-language programs on disc were distributed in unoccupied parts of Europe in the hope that they would be broadcast by resistance transmitters. No one knows if this really happened. A document account is also given on how the British right-wing extremist, Sir Oswald Mosley, tried to set up a broadcasting station outside British territory to try and get his views heard in the UK. The book goes on to examine the German propaganda stations during the Second World War. The fact that William Joyce, or Lord Haw-Haw, as he was referred to in Britain, was not the only English broadcaster from Berlin, is clearly brought out.
Germany calling, Germany calling, Germany calling. Here are the Reichsender Ambush, Station Bremen, and Station DXB on the 31-meter band.
Indeed, when the Allies entered the German capital, they found a few hundred foreigners working in the English section of the German shortwave service. Quite a lot of new detail is given on the German black broadcasting stations, like New British Broadcasting Station and Workers' Challenge. That second one was supposed to be the voice of socialist revolutionaries broadcasting from somewhere in the British Midlands. The author has obviously spent hours in various public archives. But sometimes the accuracy of the archive material should have been questioned. British newspapers have always been notorious for getting technical details of broadcasting wrong. But in his quest to present his version of what happened, West has cluttered the text with profuse footnotes in very small print. Indeed, some of the footnotes contain stories of their own, which would have been better off in the main narration. Use of more foreign reference sources might also have given a more international perspective to the conclusions drawn. In short, it's a book for the dedicated media enthusiast.
Oh, thank you, Ginger. And Truth Betrayed, written by William J. West, is published by Duckworth & Company Limited of London at a cover price in Britain of £12.95. I wonder, though, whether any of those secretly recorded programs from the Joint Broadcasting Committee will turn up in a private collection somewhere. The discs were recorded from the inside out, the opposite way from a conventional record, and used a non-standard speed of 50 revolutions per minute. So far, it appears that there's no surviving evidence of these weird wartime broadcasts.
Media Networks Cryptic Quiz, Deciphered.
A month ago, we asked you to decipher a mystery code transmission that we'd fabricated at the studios here in Hilversum. The message was a series of numbers, part of which we said had been coded.
Attention. 4, 19, 26, 7, 23, 12, 22, 8, 8, 8, 14, 22, 26, 13. End of message.
After playing around with those numbers on a piece of paper, the number 26 might have given you the clue that the ciphers simply stood for letters. One turned out to be the equivalent to Z, or Z. Two was Y, three was X, and so on backwards through the alphabet. You might have gotten the question, what does SS mean? But armed with the clues that we were looking for a radio expression, and that only part of the message was coded, you should have decoded the question, what does 88 mean? In the days of radio telegraphy, when operators from one country had to send telegrams to stations in another, a form of Morse code Esperanto developed. No matter what native language the operator spoke, the letters QRM referred to the level of man-made interference on a signal. QSL meant, can you confirm reception? And so on, through a whole list of three-letter codes, starting with letter Q. Probably as a form of pleasantry, rather than just pulling the transmitter switch at the end of a broadcast, telegraphy operators would usually exchange greetings. The number 73 came to mean best wishes, while 88 was reserved for contacts involving a female operator. It means love and kisses. So it was love and kisses that we were looking for on the competition postcards.
And a lot of people evidently had fun puzzling it out, some even spotting that it was me, Dorothy Weirs, who was giving out the code. We had 437 correct entries. Yesterday we put them in a cardboard box and first drew out the five runners-up. Each will receive a copy of the 1988 World Radio TV Handbook. The names are James Burnett of Manzini in Swaziland, Mark Leggett of Nova Scotia, Canada, Gohar Abbas of Lahore, Pakistan, Sheldon Remington of Hawaii, and F.G. Hodge of Springvale, Victoria in Australia. The top prize of the World Radio TV Handbook and a year's subscription to the newsletter Downlink goes to Gaurab Banerjee of Bihar in India. We also promised to give away some exclusive Radio Netherlands T-shirts. From the pile we picked Pete Bentley in East Aurora, New York State in the United States, Nikolai Pashkevich of Moscow in the Soviet Union, Harold Riddle of Rochester in the United States, and Miss B.D. Rathod of Bombay in India. In addition, Ian Morgan of St. Neots, Cambridge in England, and Ronald Teo of Rotterdam, here in Holland, will be getting T-shirts for their inventive entries that included some cryptic messages back to us.
Well, our congratulations to the winners there. And in fact, I'm joined now by Andy Sennett, the editor of the World Radio TV Handbook. What's been coming your way in terms of media news to the editorial offices in Amsterdam?
Well, it's been a week of rapid developments, hasn't it, George? And by the way, I like the tie. On Saturday evening, Radio Caroline resumed full-power transmissions on 558 kHz from the radio ship Ross Revenge, anchored off the British coast.
On 558 kHz, this is Radio Caroline.
And that's what they sound like here in Hilversum. They've got a new mast now to replace the old one that fell into the sea last November. For the time being, their other frequency of 819 kHz is still off the air because the diplexer, needed for dual frequency operation, has been damaged. Now here's something of interest to our European listeners who have a Teletex receiver and access to the satellite service Sky Channel. If you turn to page 340, that's 340 within the Dutch subsection, you'll find the complete frequency schedule of Dutch language programs from Radio Netherlands. And page 341 contains other media-related items. Starting shortly, this will include information supplied by the WRTH. But even if you don't speak Dutch, you'll be able to understand the times and frequencies. That's Skytext, pages 340 and 341, and your reactions are welcome. Incidentally, some national teletext services in Europe also carry brief details of their country's international services. In Belgium, the BRT International Service has its own page, 445, although you have to write and ask for the complete frequency schedule. West Germany's ARD lists the various home service shortwave frequencies on page 453, along with the main Deutsche Welle frequencies audible in Europe, and we'd be interested to hear about any similar examples. Next to South Africa, and Salvatore Placanica has sent us the printed schedule of Radio RSA, effective from March 6th. the broadcast in English to Europe is to be retimed from 2100 to 1800 UTC. A single frequency of 17880 kHz, 17880, will be used for this one-hour broadcast with a power of 500 kilowatts. And also of interest is the fact that the recently introduced Spanish language transmission at 2000 UTC on 11745 kHz, 11745, is intended specifically for Angola. A few months ago, the state-run domestic services in Greece were reorganized, and it's now become clear that this is part of a major expansion and restructuring of Greek broadcasting. Time magazine, in its issue dated the 15th of February, reports that the government has issued a notice inviting applications for licenses to operate private radio stations. These will supplement the 10 or so municipal stations which have emerged during the past couple of years. And now this.
Говорит Радио Свобода.
Yes, that's the Russian service of American-run Radio Liberty. And from the 6th of March, Radio Liberty's programs in Russian will be carried in the new 13 MHz band on 13690 kHz, 13690, between 0800 and 1300 UTC. From the 27th of March, this will be extended to 0700 to 1400. And an out-of-band frequency, 17612.5 kHz, 17612.5, will also be used for Russian between 0600 and 1400 UTC until March the 27th, and from 0700 to 1200 UTC after that date. And transmissions on these new frequencies originate from sites in West Germany. Meanwhile, broadcasting in the opposite direction, Radio Moscow has started using jingles in its North American service. Roger Tidy in London recorded this example. And still with Radio Moscow, Roger Tidy also discovered that the British service has a new feature.
Today we start a new series of programmes about the operation of Radio Moscow during the Second World War. And we begin with dramatic events that took place late in 1941 and early in 1942.
And that series is going out on Fridays in the 2000 UTC transmission.
Well, thanks, Andy.
Media Network, bringing satellite technology down to earth.
A commission of French, German, and American scientists has been busy in Cannes, France, over the past few weeks. They've been trying to decide whether it's possible to free a stuck solar panel on the West German direct broadcast satellite, TVSAT. This is Europe's first high-power direct broadcast venture, and many small electronics companies have invested nearly all their energy into designing home satellite receivers. Earlier today, the German Bundespost announced that the commission had presented their findings. Just before we came on the air, we contacted Karl Trawinski, press spokesman for the German PTT, and asked him what the specialists have concluded.
Things are not looking good. The committee who had the task to find out the fault and make the suggestions couldn't identify the fault. They have still 13 possibilities of faults. We will do a final maneuver next week, which is to give the command to unfold completely the wings, the solar generators. As far as we can see it now, only one generator will unfold. We have only a very small hope that a second one will unjam with this maneuver too. In a way, we don't even believe that there will be any movement in the jammed solar generator. It would rather be a miracle.
Without that miracle, then, the satellite simply becomes an orbiting hunk of metal. The faulty solar panel is blocking the main antenna, responsible for receiving TV pictures from Earth. So how much has this failure cost the West German government that put up the finance to launch TVSAT?
This will be, if we take away the amount the insurance pays, it will be nearly 300 million marks. So for them and for the manufacturing of the antenna dishes, this is quite a shock.
And that works out to a loss of $200 million. At the start of next year, the European Space Agency is set to launch a satellite called Olympus. One of the transponders on board will be capable of pan-European direct satellite broadcasting. We asked John Chaplin of the European Space Agency's Technology Center at Noordwijk whether the TVSAT failure will have repercussions on other projects, including theirs.
I think it affects the projects in the sense it reduces the level of confidence in the idea of DBS, and it delays the point in time where the existence of a high-power satellite in orbit actually drives up the interest and the numbers of receivers out in the shops and the number of receivers in the homes.
The West German government has now started talking to the French, who've built an identical satellite called TDF. Possible sharing of facilities is not ruled out until a replacement for TVSAT can be launched.
They've put back the launch of the French TDF-1 a little bit. We now anticipate it wouldn't be up until the autumn of this year. But they would have brought forward the launch of the one after that, which now must be a replacement for the TVSAT that was almost certainly lost. And we'd anticipate that that would be launched sometime in the middle of 1989.
The whole situation is confused because there is no European agreement as to which television standard to adopt for satellite use.
Unfortunately, there's been only a limited agreement on receiver standards, but luckily the industry is working on integrated circuits, silicon chips, which will be the basis of a multi-standard receiver, just as you can buy multi-standard receivers now if you're living in Belgium. To receive French and German and even British television, you'll be able to buy multi-standard receivers in the future of the various satellites. There has been an agreement. The French and Germans have agreed to use the same standard. The British DBS satellite, BSB, is going for a different one, and Astra still has to decide.
Astra, a commercial satellite company based in Luxembourg, is hoping to launch its DBS project later this year.
Olympus Television, public broadcasting on satellite for the whole of Europe.
The pan-European channel on the Olympus satellite was originally intended for Olympus TV, later renamed Europa Television. But since they quickly went bankrupt, what will Olympus carry now?
Yes, Europa went out of business over 2 years ago now, I think. And really a successor idea to Europa has only recently emerged, and this is the Eurosport channel, jointly owned by Rupert Murdoch's News International and a group of public service broadcasters led by the BBC.
Olympus has other potential clients too, those who want to broadcast data signals across the continent, educational broadcasters who are finding it increasingly difficult to find time on national networks, as well as groups that want to experiment with high-definition television, or extended MAC, as it's termed. In all, then, this latest setback isn't fatal.
It's big business. You only have to consider that there are something like 100 million TV homes in Europe, and cable at the moment only reaches something like 10%, 10 million of those homes. All right, cable is growing, but I would have thought in the foreseeable future it wouldn't reach more than about 20 million homes. That leaves 50, 60, 70, 80 million homes as a market for a new type of receiver to give much higher quality television. And if you multiply a figure of something like 50, 60 million by several hundred pounds or several thousand francs, you get a very big market indeed.
That was John Chaplin of ESA. Now back to you, George.
Well, that's all from Media Network for another week. The team will be back in 7 days with more from the media world. In the meantime, take care.
Some stations talk to the world. Radio Netherlands talks to people.
And that's where we end this nostalgic trip back into the Media Network audio archives from 1981 to October 2000. If you find all this stuff interesting, you might want to explore the Critical Distance website.
This is Media Network with Jonathan Marks,
where you can find more vintage audio shows, but also peruse recent video interviews I've made in the course of my travels around the world. Some of the videos actually follow up on points raised in the Media Network programme. So zip over to www.jonathanmarks.com for more details. In the meantime, this is Jonathan Marks saying back soon. Bye for now.
I regret to inform you this recording is now officially over.